Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. After Hillary Clinton lost the 2016 election, she blamed part of it on sexism, on the idea that some men and even some women had held her to impossible standards, penalized her for being female. In the years since, Clinton's loss has become a cautionary tale, a story that motivated some Democratic voters to choose Joe Biden in 2020, even if they preferred candidates like Amy Klobuchar, Elizabeth Warren, or Kamala Harris. But is the fear of female unelectability fact or fiction? We're diving into the data on it this hour, dissecting the myths around women in politics and what motivates female voters to the polls. We begin with Debbie Walsh. Walsh is the director of the Center for American Women and Politics at Rutgers University, a leading source of scholarly research and data about American women political participation. Debbie, welcome to All Sides.
Thanks for having me.
On the eve of the 2016 election, women placed flowers and "I voted" stickers on the grave of Susan B. Anthony, a suffragette who had been arrested for trying to vote more than 100 years before. And while getting to vote for the first female presidential candidate from a major party was a milestone, that night didn't end the way those voters had hoped. Clinton lost to President Donald Trump. And I wanted to begin by asking, what impact do you think that had on this idea that America isn't ready for a female president?
Well, you know, we've seen women elected around the world as heads of state. And it's so puzzling that it has taken so long. We still haven't attained it here in the United States. But this idea of women not being electable, you ask at the beginning, is it fact or fiction? I would say it's fiction. First of all, I think we all need to remember that Hillary Clinton, in fact, got more votes than Donald Trump because of our electoral system. They weren't all in the right states, and so she did not become president, but she did, in fact, get more votes. And we have a history of electing women. All the women that you mentioned who were possible choices in 2020 all have been elected to the United States Senate. In 2018, we saw record numbers of women elected to Congress, in large part in response to the defeat of Hillary Clinton. And it was, in fact, the largest incoming class of women in Congress, 36 new women elected, and 35 of them were Democrats. It was definitely a blue wave of women. And those women were responsible for flipping the House from red to blue. We've had a woman as Speaker of the House, someone who is generally seen by scholars of Congress as the most effective, one of the most, if not the most effective speakers of the U.S. House in history. So women are absolutely electable, but this myth about it does get in the way. And I think we saw that in 2020 when we saw a tremendously diverse group of candidates on the Democratic side, women, people of color. But there was this sense, we even talked about it, I remember clearly on this show, about this notion that Democrats were desperate to win and afraid of taking a risk. And women and people of color were seen as a risk. And therefore, even though folks said, you know, my preferred candidate is Amy Klobuchar or Elizabeth Warren or Kamala Harris, we can't risk it. So we're going with what looks like our traditional image of a president, an older white man. And that's how Biden got elected.
And I want to be clear, you know, Clinton did face sexist attacks in her 2016 run. There were shirts calling her a word for a female dog that I cannot say on the radio. I remember nutcrackers being sold where you essentially spread her legs to crack open your nuts. And those things were terrible. But I do want to point out that candidates get attacked for all kinds of reasons. You know, Howard Dean lost his presidential bid because he screamed too funny after a rally.
Yeah, but I think what we've seen women facing and people of color is racism, misogyny, sexism, personal attacks, questioning. I mean, you've seen it already for Kamala Harris, questioning her intelligence, questioning her racial identity. These are things that are have been, and we've seen them beyond the pale, that nutcracker that you describe. These are the kinds of things that are not about policy. They're not even a sort of a quirk in someone's presentation. These are core things about the notion that women and people of color don't belong, that they're not, they shouldn't be there. It's the otherizing of them. It's the minimizing of them. And it is a different experience. I think it will, we're seeing a different strategy in this election on the part of the woman who is running so far. But I think many of these same issues are there, and hopefully things are will be better in terms of coverage and media coverage. But this is the same opponent that Hillary Clinton faced. And he is notorious for how he talks about and treats women, powerful women who disagree with him. We saw it not just on how he talked about Hillary Clinton, but think about what he said about Carly Fiorina in the Republican primary back in 16, and then Nikki Haley this time around. So this is who he is, and this is what we can expect, both a combination of sexism and racism.
Yeah, we've heard him call her crazy Kamala, laughing Kamala, making fun of the way that she laughs. There's been some pretty disparaging false allegations that she slept her way to the top. So we're definitely seeing a lot of that narrative.
And I think what we're seeing this time around, and I think this is one of the benefits that Kamala Harris has coming into this race that Hillary Clinton did not have, which is she's got a bit of a roadmap. She will face some things that are different than Clinton faced because she is a woman of color, but she has seen a woman run for president of the United States as a major party nominee. And not only that, she's seen that woman running against the exact same person she's running against. On top of which, Kamala Harris has been elected statewide in California, nationally as vice president. This is not her first rodeo. And so far, the way in which she and the campaign are handling some of these attacks is to confront them. But in many ways, it's this kind of way of dismissing it as ridiculous, laughing at them. Some of the comments mocking them, not doing what we've heard some people call the kind of clutching of pearls, but to really just point out the ridiculousness of some of the things that he's saying. I mean, when he stood there over the weekend, talking about how, I mean, going on and on, Donald Trump did about how much more attractive he is than Kamala Harris. I mean, this is crazy. This is, we're talking about somebody running for president of the United States. There are hugely important issues that are confronting our country and the world, the planet. And he's focusing on his ego and the fact that he thinks he's more, trying to put out there that she's not attractive, that that would be the big slam on her, and how much more attractive he is.
I will say Clinton herself acknowledges that there were many different factors that contributed to her loss in 2016, including miscalculating the strength of that blue wall in the Midwest. But she does think that her likability or her lack of likability was partially due to her being a woman. And I want to play a short clip from Clinton.
With men, success and ambition are correlated with likability. So the more successful a man is, the more likable he becomes. With a woman, guess what? It's the exact opposite. So the more successful and therefore ambitious a woman is, the less likable she becomes. That's the inverse correlation that lies at the heart of a lot of the attacks and the misogyny. And it's unconscious. It's not like people, you know, say to themselves, well, you know, she's ambitious, she's successful, therefore I don't like her anymore. But the way our politics is structured and high-level public positions, that seems to be sort of baked into the reality.
Do you think that still holds true, that ambitious women are less likable than ambitious men?
I think it is still a tightrope that women in politics have to walk. You know, a successful man is perceived as attractive, smart, and appealing. I just think even back in 2020, when Elizabeth Warren was in the race and she had lots of plans for lots of problems, and she was described as school marmish. And it's a trap because women are not assumed to be qualified automatically in the ways that men are. So they have to prove their qualifications. And in the process of proving their qualifications and asserting their ideas and their intelligence and their ability to do the job, they have to look like they have ambition. And then ambition is seen as unattractive and unlikable in women. So it does become a catch-22. I also think that the complication that Hillary Clinton brought to the table was a long, long history in American politics. And people had very strong views and opinions about her before the campaign even started. One of the things that Kamala Harris has going for her in this race and on this front of kind of likability is she still is relatively unknown despite being the Vice President of the United States. And that's why this convention in the coming days is so important. And the campaign in the next few weeks leading up to the first debate, where she will be defining herself and really telling her story, her origin story, where she stands on issues, what she wants to bring, and shaping herself as the future. And I think that was part of the challenge Hillary Clinton had, was she was so well known that she was not seen as new and bringing something different to the table. And I think that was also a real challenge she faced on top of this tightrope that women do have to walk. But I want to go back to the initial idea of fact or fiction of electability, that it's fiction, that women do navigate that and they do get elected.
Yeah. And I did want to ask, though, whether you think this myth impacts whether women run for office in the first place, if maybe one of the effects of believing in unelectability is that women just choose not to run.
You know, we think that women may not make the decision to run for office for a host of reasons. One of them is when we ask men and women who serve in office what was the most important reason they ran in the first place, men will tell us they have an interest in politics and kind of playing in that world and the power connected to it. And women will tell us that the most important reason is that there was a problem they wanted to solve. And we think about that in shorthand as men run to be somebody and women run to do something. And if you sit and look at the way government is functioning these days, you would think that's not, with the polarization and gridlock, government may not be the place where you can get things done. Mm. That may not be the place where you can solve the problems. But we do know that women are running. More and more women are running, and they are, in fact, are getting elected. I think what's more chilling is the otherizing of women that comes, some of that misogyny, and the threat that women face when they run and when they serve to their physical and emotional well-being and the threats to their children and families, that this often comes with online threats, and you see it most vividly, things like the kidnapping attempt of Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, or the attack on Nancy Pelosi's husband that was in fact intended for her, or what happened on January 6th when people were screaming for Nancy Pelosi and holding her responsible for every bad thing in the world from their perspective. So I think that is more chilling and more damaging to our democracy. Because it keeps good people from thinking about running, but in particular, because women seem to face a disproportionate sort of they take the hit and disproportionately, it may really chill them from thinking about running. And then I think the discourse that we see, particularly at the national level, listening to the kinds of things that Donald Trump says about women who run for office. Not just his opponents when he's a candidate and who was running literally against him, but also, we've seen him get up and talk about the women of the squad in Congress and telling them to go back where they came from, even though almost all of them were born in the United States and all of them are serving in Congress and representing their districts. Where are they going to go back to, Minnesota or Queens or Michigan? But by talking about them and disparaging them and saying, go back to where you came from, it's a message of you don't belong here, and putting a target on their backs in very dangerous times.
My final question for you is, I wonder how much of an impact you think this myth can have on big money donors who contribute to female candidates. And sort of in that same vein, how important it was that Harris very quickly had such historic fundraising.
Yeah, we do know that women, in fact, raise comparable amounts of money to men in comparable races. And we do also know that women are less likely as candidates to self-fund their campaigns. We know that they're more reliant on small dollar donors, but that they do raise the money. And I think that this kind of discourse, particularly in this moment, we're seeing that maybe even raising money for her as a way to indicate support. She clearly has raised record amounts of money. A lot of it small dollar donors, but also quite a few major contributors and PACs and super PACs that are supporting her candidacy. So I don't think this gets in the way. And in fact, it may in fact motivate, particularly those small dollar donors who don't like what they're hearing out there and feel very emotionally connected to the idea of a woman and a woman of color running and winning the highest office in the land.
That was Debbie Walsh, Director of the Center for American Women and Politics at Rutgers University. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, we're diving into the electoral data to see whether being a woman helps or hinders candidates on Election Day. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
New from the Embedded podcast. Female athletes have always needed grit and talent. But for decades, they've also needed a certificate.
There was chit-chat about, is that really a woman?
And even now, they're still being checked and questioned. Their story is the newest series from CBC and NPR's Embedded. It's called Tested. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're talking this hour about the myth of female unelectability, separating fact from fiction about the idea that Americans aren't quite ready to elect a woman to the highest office. We're unpacking how gender plays a role in politics, and joining us now is Jenny Sweet Cushman, a professor of political science at Chatham University. Welcome to All Sides.
Hi there.
I want to start with this meta-analysis from 2022, where Suzanne Schwartz looked at 67 studies from all over the world and found that being a female politician actually produces a net gain, not a loss, a net gain of 2 percentage points. Is that surprising? Because it surprised me a little bit.
Yeah, no, I don't actually think it is, and especially in recent years in the United States, there's a phenomenon of having a baseline gender preference in your elected officials, and we know that women are both more numerous and more likely to vote. So, you know, just at the most basic level, you might see that sort of phenomenon. There's also a lot of different contexts built into that, and one of those is that there are advantages that women have in certain elected roles, you know, whether it be school board or a more legislative capacity. And those offices are seen kind of stereotypically as being a more communal place, a place where people collaborate, a place where people, you know, as part of the job, have to focus on things that are more in the caring side of things. And these are things that are stereotypically associated with women. So if you're thinking about fit for a particular office, especially in a legislative capacity, you might think that a woman is more qualified.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting. There was a paper by Sarah and Zia and Rachel Bernard in 2022 that said, quote, "Some voters infer that women candidates are more liberal than men, more compassionate and collaborative, and more competent on certain issues like education." And so that makes sense. If you're looking for a school board person and you think they're more collaborative, they're more competent, you might pick them. But what I found fascinating is that advantage sort of dissipates when we get into executive offices like mayors and governor's races.
Yes, and I have a paper drawn on an experiment that showed that there are advantages and disadvantages on both sides. And again, lots of different contexts. You know, we in the United States have to note that party is more important than gender in just about every electoral consideration. But if you're looking at those executive positions, we're more likely to think of those as requiring, you know, strength and strong leadership and, you know, forceful presence, things that we naturally are more likely to associate with men. So if we're thinking about, oh, who is the right candidate, who fits with this office, what we're looking for, and someone who's going to need to show strong leadership, that's a very natural connection to how we think about men, and maybe not as natural in thinking about women.
I want to circle back to something you touched on about partisanship, because we often talk about how the partisan divide keeps growing, and we talk about this, you know, being a bad thing for our discourse and for our country. But I do wonder if it helps female candidates, though, like if partisan trumps any concerns people have about electing women, like they're going to vote for the Democrat because they vote for Democrats or Republicans.
Yeah, absolutely. Unfortunately, and I'll go back to you saying that you know, there's this connection between women and them being more liberal. Fortunately, this benefits Democratic women much more significantly than it does Republican women. However, if a woman emerges on the Republican side through a primary, maybe she's uncontested, maybe she has a weaker opponent, you know, it's not just that they're always going to vote for the man over the woman. And if that person emerges and is on a general election ballot, you know, people are much more likely to vote for the person that has the D or the R after their name than they are based on whether they share a gender identity.
Yeah, I can't decide if I like that or I don't like that fact. It's just like, is this person on my team or not?
Yeah, and you know, I think a lot of people are apt to criticize the idea that you would vote for someone just based on their gender. Like that seemed like kind of an icky concept. And I like to push back on that a little bit, because if you don't know anything else about a candidate, which a lot of voters don't, you know, especially in lower level offices, or in, non-presidential races, then, if you have lived experience that overlaps with the candidate's lived experience, I mean, it's not a bad guess for someone that whose values might align with yours. So, if people are making a decision between two candidates based on gender, they're actually using a very rational model for making that decision.
That does kind of answer my next question, which was, does it matter where a female candidate appears on the ballot? Because a woman running for president or for a U.S. Senate seat is probably much more well-known to the electorate than someone running for a nonpartisan local race.
Yeah, so low information, and that's the difference there, is that if you are in a high-profile U.S. Senate, president, governor, then, people are going to know more about you than just what your gender is. And so that baseline preference that people might have comes much more into play when they're looking at a list of names for, judicial races. And we actually see women in states where we elect judges do quite well in judicial races. Hmm. So is that baseline preference something that's coming into play there? And again, if that's all you know about the person, because you can look at their name and try to discern that, that's all the information that you have. So that might be how some people are making those decisions.
One of the things I found fascinating in looking at the data is that it's really changed in the last 30 to 40 years. So if you were a woman running for office in the 90s, there was a net negative for being a female, but it's gone away, essentially.
Yeah, absolutely. And I trace this very profoundly to Title IX.
Hmm.
And when, suddenly so many more women were accessing higher education and thus professions that are pipeline professions to elective office. And so now you have all of these much more qualified women going into elective office, but also going into lots of high profile places that make women seem like they're in the business of helping the economy run, the education system run, the legal system run, all of these different sectors, high profile sectors of our society, suddenly were open to women who were able to get the education to access them. And so as that happened, you have many more women who are positioned in places where they can be recruited for office, they can feel qualified for office, and voters see them in all of those spaces and can start thinking about politics as not necessarily being a man-only space, but rather something that, the entire society can share.
I want to talk about the 2018 midterm election here in the United States for a moment, because after Clinton loses in 16, a record number of women run in 2018. And when you add up all the victories from that cycle, women won at higher rates than men, and Democratic women in particular, who became responsible for flipping the majority of U.S. House seats, which changed partisan control of that chamber. And I sort of wonder, looking at that and the cycles since, if things have actually changed here in how we view female politicians since 2016.
Sure. I think they have. We'll have to wait and see whether that's a permanent change or not. I think the most important thing that happened, and there were a lot of different reasons that gender was so salient in 2018, but I think it was 2016 served as a wake-up call for American women that, they're looking around like, this doesn't look so good. Like, what is going on in this country? And realizing, maybe the person who has to fix it is me. And so we always say, in the gender and politics research, it's not even, there's not really an electoral penalty on average for women running for office. It's that fewer women than men run for office. And so you can't get to parity if you don't have the women candidates. In 2018, you see this huge increase in women candidates. And that means that, women are competing for seats. It means that they're running at lower levels and creating a pipeline to higher level office. And so this should be a structural change in how we see American politics function moving forward. Now, does everything get fixed? Probably not. And suddenly women are like, oh, good, we got that under control. we can go off and only focus on our families and, lean into our careers and the things that we were doing, before we got all excited about politics. Let's hope not. And I don't think so. I don't think there's any going back from that.
Yeah, 2018 was also the first time we had a state where women were the majority in a state legislature. That happened in Nevada. Female lawmakers there hold 60% of the seats and 2/3 of the congressional delegation, including both U.S. Senate seats. So it was also the first time we saw a majority of women in a delegation.
Yeah, no, and I've done some interviews with women who were in that first majority in Nevada. And it was interesting to see the things that they emphasized, things that probably a casual observer wouldn't realize, but, the cultural change that took place in the institution around, how people were talking to witnesses in hearings was different. The types of things that were prioritized on the legislative agenda were different. And creating that pipeline so that, you're training all of these, and they have term limits in Nevada so that, there's a lot of women coming through the system now. And so, can they go from a representative to Senate, and then looking at the congressional seats and the Senate seats as well, not surprising that there are so many women when there, over the last few election cycles, have been so many who now have that critical experience and credibility to run for a higher level office too.
I want to unpack a little bit the assumptions we make about how women vote and why they vote, because there's a lot of conversation right now about, women are voting for Kamala because she's a woman. And that assumes that our gender trumps party, trumps our politics, trumps how we feel about inflation, education, the war in Gaza. And I feel like it's a really reductive analysis to say, women are going to vote for her because she's a woman.
I think women are more excited to vote because she's a woman. And wouldn't it be weird if women were not excited at the idea of the first woman president? I think even if the party I do not share an identity with were to elect a woman president, I would be excited about breaking that glass ceiling. So the enthusiasm, I think, is what people are picking up on. Now, independents are always kind of a strange group to talk about because they're independent for so many different reasons. But she seems to be polling really well among independents. And so I think there where people tend to be less informed, less engaged in politics, paying less attention to, partisan conflict and issues, they might make a decision based on, gosh, I'd really like to see the first woman president. And again, I would argue that's not a bad reason to make a decision to vote, because if you think it's important that women have leadership in American politics, that's a very rational and legitimate reason to choose a candidate.
And it would be the worst reason I've ever heard as to why somebody picked a candidate.
Absolutely.
I mean, there's that, we've always had that likability factor, right? That one of the problems that, say, Mitt Romney or Al Gore ran into is they weren't the kind of guy you wanted to have a beer with, which has nothing to do with public policy.
Nothing. And that has always driven me crazy because, get me someone who is amazing with policy and can do, important things and move the country forward, and they can have beer on their own. Right? I don't need to have a beer with them.
Yeah. So I do think when it comes down to how much we pay attention, why we pick, I think that's important. Like, if somebody is voting because a candidate is a woman, there is this idea out there that somehow we denigrate people for making that choice.
Yeah, no, and I think if you know more, you should rely on those things. But if you don't, even if you just have the most basic understanding of the differences between the Republican and the Democratic Party, then you should pick the one that aligns with your values. And gender can be that too. I'm a stepmom, Kamala's a stepmom, I know we have a shared experience in some way, those kinds of things are important. Now, at the level of the presidency, I would hope that it would be more than that. But if you're making those decisions at lower level office, that might be a good way to make decisions if you have no other means for doing so.
That was Jenny Sweet Cushom, Associate Professor of Political Science at Chatham University. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, we're continuing our conversation on the myth of the unelectability of women. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
New from the Embedded podcast. Female athletes have always needed grit and talent. But for decades, they've also needed a certificate.
There was chit-chat about, is that really a woman?
And even now, they're still being checked and questioned. Their story is the newest series from CBC and NPR's Embedded. It's called Tested. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're talking this hour about women in politics and the myth that somehow females are less electable than their male counterparts. We're now joined by Dustin Harp, director of the Gender, Women, and Sexuality Study Program at the University of Texas Arlington. Professor Harp, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you for having me.
And we also have Democratic Ohio State Representative for Toledo, Michelle Grimm. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Representative Grimm, I want to start with you. So you're a woman in elected office in Ohio. Can I ask what motivated you to run and what's it been like getting elected?
So I first ran in the height of the pandemic for Toledo City Council, and I think that's what kind of motivated me as a public health professional. And then shortly after I was elected, there was an opportunity to run for the state house, and I decided to run for that seat as well. And you know, being a woman in elected office has some positives and some challenges. I think that it's a good reminder that women hold up half the sky, and we talk about a lot of the issues that a lot of people care about. But the challenging side, though, too, is especially around social media. You do have people who I've had people who attack me on my appearance and my policy. Yeah, I get that a lot. So that can be a little challenging. So you have to tune all that out. But by and large, being an elected official, being a woman and being an elected official has been a very rewarding experience. I think that, again, considering that we still don't have a lot of gender parity in women in elected office, I think Represent Women gave us a D in Ohio this year. So we still have a lot of work to do, but I am glad to be in the position I am to fight for a lot of the issues that women in Ohio care about.
Professor Harp, you've written about why sexist coverage of women in politics matters. And I want to talk a little bit about that, particularly with what Representative Grimm said and what I've experienced in my own limited public life, that women get a lot more comments about our appearance, about the sound of our voices, about our mannerisms, our clothes. We're very nitpicked upon.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, the more you're in public, the more it's going to happen. There's this idea that women, you know, culturally, we don't take up public space, we take up private space. But when we are in public, this whole idea of, you know, keep your mouth closed and look pretty, which is from generations ago, but we still have these cultural expectations a bit. And there's been lots and lots of research over the decades that has shown through systematic analysis that women politicians
when they are covered in media or in social media, talked about in social media, their looks and appearance and body are often discussed before their policy and politics.
Do you see other common tropes in media coverage of women in politics?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I'm finding it really interesting right now. Remember, you know, Hillary Clinton, you know, she had the cackle, which was, you know, if we think about what a cackle is, it kind of makes people think of a witch, right? And well, and now I'm seeing that Kamala Harris, there's discussion about her laughing and her giggling. And I'm seeing it as a giggle, right? I've been seeing that word. As though somehow joy and happiness and laughter is a problem. But what it does is it creates that binary, that dichotomy of serious versus silly, right? Women in politics and women in the public hit this double bind, right? Where you're not, if you're silly, that's not okay. But if you're too serious, that's not okay, because women shouldn't be too serious. I see it as well in terms of being aggressive versus assertive, right? Assertive is okay for a man. And in fact, in politics, a man should be assertive. But if a woman is assertive, it's more aggressive and pushy and other, you know, words that we can't say on the radio.
Yes, please don't.
Yes, no. So those are examples of kind of this double bind women are in. Women, you know, I also did analysis, you know, so much was talked about, and I know I'm talking about Hillary Clinton a lot, but she really kind of broke some ground, right? But, you know, her pantsuits and her clothing, but then also there was so much discussion, does she spend too much on her clothing? So it's like there's no winning there. But how often do we hear about clothing when it comes to male politicians? I will point out the one time we really did was Barack Obama's tan suit.
Oh, my goodness. I remember that. There was such a controversy over that suit.
Right, right. And what I'll maintain is he's also marginalized, right? He was Black. So there was a space for attacking him about his clothing in the same way we attack marginalized politicians who are women about their clothing. And then, you know, I do want to just really point out too, with Kamala Harris and women of color, AOC, we also get that angry Black woman, angry Latina. So there's these intersections of how gender and race play into these discourses or discussions as well. And I think it's important that we recognize that.
Representative Grimm, the House Minority Leader of your party is Allison Russo, a woman. And then over in the Senate Minority Leader is Nikki Antonio, also a woman. So at least here in Democratic circles, do you feel like women are pretty well representative in leadership, at least at the state level in Ohio?
And I am the assistant whip in the minority caucus. So, you know, we have half women leadership. It used to be 75%. So, you know, I think that women are well represented in leadership, at least on the Democratic side. But as I mentioned before, only 29% of our elected officials are in the state house are women. I think actually statewide is 29%, and Represent Women gave us a D. And so we have a long way to go for gender parity in elected office. So, you know, I think that there's still a lot of work to do, and there are still myths that perpetuate about women being unelectable. And, you know, I think there's a lot of data to pinpoint that that's not really the case. And I did like the end of that Atlantic piece about the myths, is that if we continue to say it, it's going to become true. So I think we need to, like, again, make sure that we are highlighting the accomplishments of women in elected office. We do so much policy-wise, for our constituents. And, you know, I think it's really important to really highlight our wins and our accomplishments here in office.
How do we convince more women to run? And I guess that's a question for either of you.
So I will say that I've heard a statistic where it takes 7 asks for women to say yes to run for office. And I think it's a lot more challenging for women because I don't have any children, but women, there's a lot of women who have children and they're usually the caretaker of children. They may not be able to afford to quit their job to campaign full time. I think there's just a lot of factors for women when they decide to get into politics that men really don't have. So I think really the best way to get more women to run for office is to support them. I was also struck by the Atlantic piece that a lot of donors are more reluctant to give money to women, and it costs money to run for office. So believing in women, knowing that women can win when they run, and women can really make change in office when we're here.
Right. I would say, I mean, you know, this matters, how we talk about women in the public matters, because there's still research that illustrates that even Democrats are less likely to donate or give or vote for a woman. So I think that we really need to change this public narrative, this cultural narrative. And I think talking about it, you know, I think there's good news. Having researched this for over 20 years, there are programs and mainstream media talking about these exact issues that we're talking about today. So being able to point out these issues, and for media and just the general culture to start treating women better in the public will make a difference, because a lot of women, they get into public life and they want out because it's so abusive, you know? So I think that the more journalists can concentrate on women as politicians and not women politicians. Because when we're highlighting in media and in our public discourse that they're women, through talking about their clothing, talking about their familial role, those things highlight that this person is a woman. We need to get over that and just politicians are politicians.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about Nancy Pelosi, the former Speaker of the House. She's proven to be one of the most powerful politicians in Washington. And whether you love her politics or you hate them, I would put her on equal footing with Mitch McConnell in terms of her political acumen. I wonder how much seeing women like Nancy Pelosi in leadership goes towards changing that narrative, Professor Harb.
Well, you know, I like to quote this one sentence, which is, you can't be what you can't see. So young girls are now, and young women are seeing women in power, and it makes them realize they can be that. So I think the more we get to see women in powerful positions, so I do think she's going to, I think it makes a difference. But, you know, we know so much about how many grandchildren she has, and I know nothing about how many grandchildren Mitch McConnell has. And also her looks are always front and center and discussed. So, you know, it's this double-edged thing again.
Yeah. Representative Graham, and I guess Professor Harp, this is a question for both of you. Do you think the electorate has changed since 2016 when it comes to electing a woman for the highest office here in America?
I think there's still going to be some challenges, because again, the issues that Professor Harp has mentioned is that, you know, the criticisms of Kamala Harris are her laugh, her clothes,
mispronouncing her name.
Yeah, mispronouncing her name. Absolutely. I mean, just all of these really petty things that goes into attacking someone for their appearance or their name. So I think it's you know, there's still some challenges, but I do see a big shift in excitement right now. I think a lot of younger women are excited to go vote for Vice President Harris. And, you know, I certainly have seen it in my community that a lot of people are just really excited, and hopefully there is going to be a shift now between now and 2016, because I think you do see a lot more women in power and the change that we can make in elected office.
Yeah, and I'd like to hop in if I have a minute and say that
just about
I
30
also,
seconds, but yeah.
Okay. Well, I teach young students, I mean, you know, young people, and they're very excited about a shift. And I think that younger people are less concerned about whiteness, and they're also excited about youth. Whether it's a woman or a man, it's a younger person. So, and yeah, so I think, and Hillary kind of cracked that glass ceiling, and I think now it's time to be shattered, and I'm very hopeful.
That was Professor Dustin Harp, Director of the Gender, Women, and Sexuality Program at the University of Texas. Thank you to her and Representative Michelle Grimm.